Today, four lives cut short by COVID-19 and what their stories tell us about who is being killed by this disease. Policing in the East End of London in the 1960s was a tough job, often done by huge, burly men. Leonard Nipper Reed was different.
Why was he called Nipper?
Nipper because he was so small. I think he took stretching exercises and scraped into the Met at 5'8".
Back then, fighting crime was much more low-tech.
DNA didn't exist in the 60s. Forensic science didn't exist in the way it does today.
But Nipper could turn his height to his advantage.
He didn't look like a policeman. He could take various jobs, as it were, in disguise. And really, because he was so small, people wouldn't think, oh gosh, there's a copper. He was a dapper little man, very neat. And so he passed himself off as a milkman, a bookmaker's clerk, a road sweeper, naval petty officer, delivery boy, Hertz chauffeur. He was the absolute archetypal police officer in disguise, and no one noticed him.
He might have been a master of disguise, but unlike some of his colleagues, he wasn't corrupt.
The funny thing was, all criminals respected him. He got on well with them. He wasn't dishonest. If he said he would do something for them, he would. He wouldn't betray them. He didn't fake confessions. He didn't beat them up. The wife of one robber said to me he was a perfect gentleman.
Author James Morton has spent his career immersed in the same criminal underworld where Nipper operated, writing about some of Britain's best-known gangsters, including the most infamous of all, the Cray twins, brothers Ronnie and Reggie.
The Crays have established the grip on East London crime. They are the big villains of around Whitechapel. And the Crays ran long-term frauds, protection, that sort of thing.
Nipper had investigated the great train robbery of 1963, but trying to take down the Crays would be the challenge of his life. And they saw him as a worthy adversary.
Yes, they had two pythons called Fred and Nipper, which they bought at Harrods. Harrods had a pet shop on the top floor, I think, at one time. By now, the Crays think they're invincible.
But it turned out they weren't. First, they got reckless when Ronnie Cray murdered a rival gangster in the packed Blind Beggar pub in East London in 1966. And then they orchestrated the killing of two members of their own organisation. Their missteps would provide Nipper Reed, then aged 41 and rising through the ranks of London policing, with the opening he needed. And he turned to his favoured method of investigation, disguise.
He arranges for policewomen to just go up and down the streets pretending to be doing a house-to-house survey for a washing powder. And eventually they come across one of the women who starts talking and says, yes, it's this house where the murder took place.
But it was Nipper himself who would lay down the final piece of the jigsaw, posing as a vicar to meet a close associate of the Crays in the chapel of Brixton Prison, where he was given the crucial evidence that finally brought them down.
The pair of them got life for 30 years. Meticulous, good, old-fashioned coppering.
He's a bit of a legend, basically.
Oh, yes, certainly.
And presumably losing figures like him is quite significant because they can tell you things about a time that no longer exists.
Yes, I think that's right. I mean, he was 95 when he died, and there really is nobody of his era left.
Nipper survived all sorts in his decades-long career in the Met. The police even foiled an assassination attempt, allegedly by the Crays themselves. But in the end, it was COVID-19 that killed him. There have now been well over 20,000 hospital deaths in the UK as a result of this virus, and many, many more in the community. On the question of who is dying, the statistics tell a story about age and gender. Men are being killed at twice the rate of women, and like Nipper, many are older, the vast majority over 60. but still with plenty of life ahead of them. Then there are questions about race. Many of those lost are black or minority ethnic. And income, as data slowly unravels the myth of an indiscriminate spread. What about people on the front line? Not just hospitals and care homes, but supermarkets and buses, who place themselves at a greater risk by simply going to work. Or others, who simply don't fit the profile, but die anyway. Behind every statistic is a life and a story. From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, the lives cut short by COVID-19. The person singing is Omar Afzal. He was an interpreter, Urdu and Pashto into English. His work took him into official meetings, police stations and courtrooms. He was always smartly dressed, always in a suit. His hair was always perfect. Language was his work, but it was also his life. He spoke 6 different languages, but the one that he cared about the most was Pashto. The language, the culture, and, as his brother Nazir remembers all too well, the music.
If he'd turn up at court with his accordion and his tabla, he would, you know. he absolutely loved music. He loved Pashto music. I mean, I must admit, I detested it with a vengeance.
Did you?
Absolutely. It's so samey for me. Yeah, he absolutely adored it, and sometimes you have to say to him, you know, leave your music at home, don't bring it to the party, they've got their own DJ, you know? He will still turn up with something, just in case.
There are literally hundreds of videos of your brother singing songs in Pashto at weddings, at big gatherings of people. There's a lot of laughter and fun. He's a really good singer. I mean, how much joy did that all bring him?
Oh, extraordinary. Yeah, he was extraordinarily proud of his heritage. He had a radio program on a South Asian channel where it was the Pashto show.
I'm in love from Lahore, Pakistan. Welcome ji, pakhair ali, welcome khushamadid.
But he was also really keen on ensuring that young people were able to contribute to the society that they were part of and not feel alone.
Hello boy, how are you? Can you speak in Pashto?
No,
you can't speak Pashto. Do you want to say Happy New Year to all your all the friends here?
Yeah.
Go on, say it.
Happy
New Year.
New Year.
Ah, well done, well born. Thank you.
And the actual job of an interpreter, I mean, in the few days he's been gone now, I can't begin to tell you how many messages I've had. Police officers or officials or people who benefited from his skills who've all said how... if it wasn't for him, it would have been so much more difficult, or they wouldn't have necessarily got their points across. He was highly regarded. It's a shame, actually, and really the greatest shame is that he can't see what people are saying about him now, because I wish I'd said it to him more frequently than I did.
What did you wish he'd said?
He made me immensely proud, and still does.
None of the people we spoke to for this episode were 100% sure how their loved ones contracted COVID-19, but each of them had their own theory. Nazir's theory about his brother is a sad one. He thinks he caught it while visiting their 91-year-old mother in hospital, where she was being treated for pneumonia and a patient in the next room had COVID-19. Soon, Omar wasn't eating and he looked like a pale shadow of himself. He was admitted to hospital, where he was given a blood test.
and then he was sent home.
I don't know what the decision-making was. All I know is that a handful of days later, 5 days later, he went to bed and didn't wake up. And it was only then, one of my nieces is a doctor, and she said, you know, what happened to that blood test? And they said, yeah, he tested positive for COVID-19. So we find that out 24 hours after he passed on. I just set off, and it's 90 minutes down the road. I didn't listen to any music. I just simply thought about him all the way down. And then there he was. And, you know, we then contacted an Islamic undertaker. The Islamic undertaker said, I can come, but I won't be able to come until I've dealt with the other 14 bodies that I'm picking up today. So it was 8 hours after he'd been found before finally he was taken. We had this most surreal experience where he's lying on the bed, passed away. My mother is next to him with her oxygen tank. My sister, my brothers, and we're all wearing masks and gloves. And the imam comes in with his masks and gloves. And we're doing this on the basis that we think he's got COVID, despite the fact that nobody had told us. And eventually the undertaker came to collect his body. And then my mother, who's now come down, that somehow managed to come downstairs with her oxygen tank, says, can I have one last look at my son's face? And so the trolley's outside. He's inside a zip bag. And you know, me and my brother open the zip bag so that she could see through the window her eldest's face.
People from all over Birmingham tried to come to Omar's home to pay their respects in collective prayer. But because of social distancing, the family had to turn them away. They posted messages in WhatsApp groups urging people not to come. In Islamic tradition, the body should be buried as soon as possible so that the soul can move on. But because Omar had died at home, not in hospital, the death certificate had to be issued by a coroner, which took 6 days. In the meantime, Omar's body was kept in a fridge. When the death certificate finally came, it confirmed that he died of COVID-19. Omar had always wanted to be buried in Pakistan along with his father. But this also was not to be. His funeral took place 9 days after his death at Handsworth Cemetery in Birmingham.
In Islam, you have a ritual washing of the body, which is called the ghusl. And we decided, and we weren't dissuaded from it, that we would carry out the ghusl ourselves, but we would do so in protected equipment. So the brothers, i.e. me and my four brothers now, and his eldest son, took it upon ourselves to wash his body in a mortuary, in effect. And I'll be honest with you, I felt really privileged to be able to hold his body, to be able to wash his body, to be able to perfume his body. It was almost like being able to say goodbye to him properly. I combed his hair back to make him look as handsome as he did in real life. This is probably the most painful bit, to be frank. My mother hasn't got Alzheimer's or dementia. She hasn't got either of those, but I think she'd forgotten that he had died. Or through shock, had put it out of her mind. It was obviously extraordinarily emotional for all of us, but particularly for her. She has seen so much pain. She lived through partition. She lived through wars. She's seen people, members of my family, murdered and killed and in 50, 60, 70, 80 years. So, you know, if anybody's strong enough to deal with it, it's her, but she shouldn't have had to. Her one prayer, strange as it may sound, her one prayer that she has been saying for 75 years, day in, day out, is that she should be a pass before her children. And that one didn't come true. He had a suitcase packed in his house, which was ready to take my mother's body to Pakistan. Nobody expected him to be the one that passes first.
One of the things that strikes me about your story was the fact that your brother died at home, and the fact that had you not sought out that blood test result, you may never have even known that he had COVID-19. Does your experience suggest that there may be families all over the country losing loved ones to this disease who were not even included in those statistics?
I'm 100% certain that the government have underestimated or underrecorded the number of people who have been impacted by COVID-19. COVID-19 attacks your organs. So you might have kidney failure, you might even have cardiac arrests, et cetera, et cetera. But if you haven't been tested, and we haven't tested hardly anybody, have we? You have no idea. And you just give them a death certificate and you get them buried off. And we have so many people suffering this way.
Nazir, I follow you on Twitter. You're a prominent figure in the legal profession. You used to be chief prosecutor for the Northwest, and I saw you tweet before any of this about some of the people who had died working for the NHS, and you pointed out that many of them were Muslim. I saw a second post where you highlighted a newspaper front page that had slightly weirdly only featured the white nurses who had died. And you got a barrage of abuse as a result of that. What do you think that was about?
Well, I've learned the hard way, never read my notifications. I suggest you do the same.
Oh, I definitely don't.
It is the only way of surviving what social media throws at you. I knew I would get that. I don't care. You know, I know what I feel. I know what I see. Where I am in Birmingham is, I think, the second largest group of people dying from COVID. And, you know, one will have to understand why. Nurses and doctors have died disproportionately from minority communities, and families are having to deal with that themselves. It makes me immensely angry that is what we are having to deal with individually and as a community.
Like Nazir, I know that talking about race can make some people feel uncomfortable. When you raise it on social media, you can get accused of playing the race card. But it is indisputable that ethnic minorities are dying in disproportionately high numbers. Research by The Guardian suggests that in England, their deaths could be overrepresented by 27%. One of the possible reasons is that ethnic minorities are more likely to live in densely populated cities. Some of the worst hit places in the country have high BAME populations, like Harrow and Brent in London, and in parts of Birmingham, like where Umar died. But even when you take regional factors into account, there is a mismatch, especially when you consider that minorities tend to be younger and people who die of COVID-19 tend to be older. Could it be a higher rate of diabetes, or that ethnic minorities are more likely to be poor and live in crowded accommodation? We don't know, and that is why all of this will now be investigated in an official government inquiry. As we wait for answers, it is hard to miss the number of black and brown faces among the photo galleries of those who have died. Umar's story also leaves me wondering how many others are dying at home of COVID-19 but are being left out of official figures. And how many are we losing because of the risks they take in frontline jobs? Not just in the NHS and social care, where we have lost more than 100 health workers, but in so many other settings, including on the buses, where unbelievably 34 workers have died of COVID-19. That is a third of the number of health workers.
My name's Penny Palmer. I'm a 33-year-old NHS worker. I'm based at Lewisham Hospital, Paediatrics, A&E.
And your dad's Mervyn Malley Kennedy, who was a bus driver from Croydon and who has sadly passed away.
Yes, everyone knows him, Mally.
Mally and his wife, Pat, brought their daughters to Britain from Zimbabwe in 2001 in search of a better life. Although it wasn't clear straight away, for Penny at least, whether Croydon would be better than Hwange.
No word of a lie, we used to have elephants eating in our back garden. That's how rural it was.
Wow.
I know.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it was a big culture shock.
In 2004, Mally was training to become a bus driver when his wife, Pat, developed pneumonia and sadly died.
I mean, she took ill over the weekend, and when she was ill, she did say, Mally, you make sure that you qualify. Don't worry about me. You make sure you do what you need to do. And yeah, he made it his life's mission to do that and to look after his girls.
What sort of dad was he?
I don't know, sounds so cliche, but he was the best dad I could have ever asked for. He's so patient, so kind, very caring, always hands-on. I mean, he was never a big talker. So my dad showed love by giving us everything we needed. He was the type of father that would give you his last penny, even if he didn't have anything left of his own. I mean, he'd come and visit me and he'd always be like, right, what needs fixing? It was that type of dad. He taught us all how to play an instrument. I took on the keyboard. My other two sisters took on the guitar.
So he loved music?
He loved music. He could sing. He was always jamming on his electric guitar at home. He liked rock. He liked jazz. He liked rhythm and blues.
So a noisy house.
Yeah, very noisy house. The week before he passed, funny enough, he was over here teaching my eldest daughter how to play the keyboard. And so he made sure he left that legacy within the family, the music legacy, so to speak.
Did he like being a bus driver?
He did. Funny enough, he did. We always used to ask him, be like, Dad, you've been driving the bus for 16 years, surely. But he used to say he likes his job, gives him time to think and reflect. So I used to drive the 250, Thornton Heath to Brixton and all the way back. I jumped on it just to show the kids. They called him Poppy or Pops. This is the bus your Pops drives. And they'd get so excited because, like, oh, we jumped on the bus and my granddad's driving the bus. But yeah, he never complained. He never complained about his job at all.
Since COVID-19 has hit, I've spoken to a couple of bus drivers who were working and they were really scared. They talked about almost imagining as passengers got on that they might have the disease, that they could be passing it over with cash or breathing it through the holes. I mean, do you know whether your dad was worried about it?
I think in the beginning, no. I do remember speaking to him over the phone and saying, do you have PPE at work? And he said, no, they've said they've cleaned the buses and they've given us gloves. And I was like, Dad, gloves are not going to protect you. I was like, you need more so a mask. And that's when I went out and got him a mask and hand sanitizer.
Were you frustrated that bus drivers weren't being given protection?
When I heard my dad reply with sort of, oh, well, we'll be fine kind of attitude, I was a little bit frustrated in terms of I wish they pushed for it more, because my dad is a man that, I'm just his daughter nagging at him, but if someone senior was to say, no, you need to put on your protective equipment, who knows, maybe it would be a different outcome. I don't know that for sure.
Can you tell me how he caught coronavirus?
I don't know personally how he caught it. All I know is that when we had the lockdown rules, the only thing he did was go to work and come home.
As a nurse, Penny went to see her dad twice to try to help, dressing in a mask and gloves and with a makeshift apron made out of a bin bag to examine him. At one point, they thought he was through the worst, even celebrating his 67th birthday over FaceTime. But Mally's condition soon deteriorated and he was taken to hospital. He was then ventilated, but soon doctors suggested that for his dignity, the family should consider withdrawing treatment.
I do believe Croydon, speaking with them, speaking with the consultant and the anaesthetist, I do want to send out a big thank you. I do believe they tried everything they could with my dad. My sister then called myself and my sister and we had a sort of like a conference call and all decided that it was for his best interest that we withdraw care.
How hard was that conversation?
I mean, no words can describe, really. I mean, even now, it still gives me goosebumps talking about it. It's not easy. Someone's life is in your hands, and that decision to withdraw care, it's not one you take lightly.
What happened then? Was he on his own?
So, yes, he was on his own. So before they withdrew care, the anaesthetist offered to FaceTime my dad, but we said, oh, we don't want to remember him with tubes and ventilators down his throat. So I asked her if she wouldn't mind putting the phone to his ear, which she did. And we kind of said our last goodbyes then. And I don't know if he heard us, but I do remember saying, "Dad, it's okay to let go. We will be fine." And we're all Christians. My sister just said to him, "Dad, just make sure you pray and give your life to God, and hopefully we'll see you soon."
How you're a medic, you've been in hospitals, you understand this process. How devastating is this disease in terms of not allowing relatives to be with their loved ones when they pass away?
Oh, it's horrible. It's absolutely horrible. It's devastating. I mean, thank God for the nurses. So we were told that two nurses held his hand while he passed. It's your loved one. It's your loved one, and they're all alone and they're dying and they don't have the comfort of their families next to them, and it's horrible. And I mean, I understand the precautions. Honestly, I do. And it does not make sense to keep exposing more people to the disease. But at the same time, how do you say goodbye to someone you love and you can't even be there? It's just...
And presumably, it also affects the funeral.
There's a maximum of 15 people can go. We can't have a service. It will just literally be by the graveside.
How many people would have been there, do you think?
Oh, loads, loads. If I had to put a number on it, maybe 300. He was a very loved man.
Do you think your dad saw himself as a frontline worker who was basically almost doing a public duty and carrying on with his job and putting himself at that risk?
Definitely. I mean, my dad was 67, so it would be considered an elderly man. He was a senior bus driver, and I did speak to him about maybe not going to work. But no, my dad was very dedicated to his job and sort of saw that he needed to be at work. And he would say, "I need to go to work. Who's going to do my job for me?" He was not a man to sort of sit at home and twiddle his thumbs.
It's impossible not to notice how much overlap there are in these stories of families unable to grieve in the middle of a crisis that is keeping us all apart, of deaths alone. So far, we've talked about Mali, Umar and Nipa, all over 60, all men. Thank God this disease doesn't appear to be affecting children on anything like the same scale, perhaps because there are so many more underlying conditions among the older population. But why men? In China, where half of men smoke and hardly any women do, some asked if it could be that. But that doesn't explain how the virus carried that gender disparity into Europe and beyond. Some think it's to do with how men behave. Studies say they're less likely to wash their hands, less likely to use soap, less likely to seek medical care, and more likely to ignore public health advice. As my colleague Hannah Devlin, a science correspondent, has written, these are sweeping generalisations, but they could place men at a greater risk across the whole population. But it's not conclusive, so academics are also delving deeper, asking if there's something more fundamental going on at a genetic or hormonal level that means men have a weaker immune response. But look, statistics about age, sex, race, they're only one part of the story of COVID-19. The truth is, the disease can hit anyone. Coming up, Sarah Breeden-Kemp tells us about the amazing life of her best friend, the 29-year-old nurse, Rebecca Mack. Tell me about the first time you ever met Rebecca.
We had friends in common and we just kind of met through the pub. It was very strange because I'm a very kind of introverted person. I'm a bit nervous around people. So I was quite intimidated by this kind of like bombastic, glittery princess character who was like trying to be my best friend. She would like drag me around all the shops in Morpeth and like treat me like a grumpy husband. So I'd have to hold all of her clothes while she went and tried everything on. She loved, loved, loved leopard print. Like, she really had this, like, Pat Butcher aesthetic that was really, really iconic and well-known around our friendship group. Huge, big eyeliner, some kind of loud, obnoxious lipstick, like, everything going on.
Were you the same?
No, not at all. I've got a bit of, like, a kind of like gothy aesthetic. Like, I wear a lot of black. So we're kind of, like, polar opposites, really, in a lot of ways.
Going to say, you must have looked like a right pair.
Oh, yeah. People ask me all the time, why are we friends? And I still to this day, I'm not exactly sure.
Go on, let me try. Why were you friends?
She wasn't really like anyone else that I've ever met. She had this kind of like ditzy demeanor, but she was also like fiercely intelligent. So it was kind of funny how her personality didn't always kind of match up with kind of how she looked. And she would love when people would underestimate her or talk down to her. She loved proving people wrong.
Tell me about her becoming a nurse.
Oh, she always wanted to be a nurse right out of school. And she went straight out of school to do her qualification. And then from there went straight on to working at the Children's Oncology Unit in the Royal Victoria Infirmary, the RVI, as we call it. And she suited it down to a T because she just was so, so bright and bubbly. And she had just this ability to cheer people up. And I think one of the most important things she did there was really make sure that the kids had a proper childhood and made sure they had things to play with and would like joke with them. And she loved putting a smile on their face. It's been
must
really
have been
touching.
A hard job.
Oh,
sad
yeah,
job.
Really, really hard. Like she would often say, like when Becca came home from work and said she'd had a bad day, you kind of knew what it meant.
That she'd lost someone.
Yeah. And that's really hard because she was like so invested in all of the kids. I think the nurses did their best to look after each other. And I know that they all had their own kind of routines of like going into cupboards for a little cry. And I know that she also often kind of celebrated for the kids who went into remission and got better. And then she also had a few gifts from the families of the children who didn't make it on a shelf and stuff. And they were really treasured objects for her, just little toys and photos and stuff like that.
Rebecca's parents have set up a Just Giving page to raise money for the Children's Cancer Fund. And yes. If you scroll through the donations, you can just see how many lives she touched, people who knew her from school or the Girl Guides when she was younger. But it's striking how many people she impacted through her work, not just the children she was caring for, but as you say, their families too. Let me just read you a couple of things. This is Andrew Howard. Becca was our son's nurse on the 3.5 years we were inpatients. She was fantastically fun, caring, and gave us some right laughs. She brightened us up on some of the worst days of our lives. Oh, God, sorry, I don't want to cry. Linda Fraser, such a dreadful shame. Rebecca was among the wonderful staff who nursed my grandson, Daniel, when he was suffering from leukemia. Thankfully, he survived. A lovely nurse who always made our son laugh. Such an amazing nurse. One of the lovely nurses who looked after our little boy. Sadly, he never got better, but it was not for the want of trying. And so on and so on. Does that make you proud?
It makes me so proud. I think if she was still here, it'd be such a collision of worlds for her, because obviously she touched so many people's lives. And to hear them all those stories in such quick succession is like overwhelming, really. It's like hard to process that one person could have done all that. And I know that she was so proud of what she did. And when she eventually left, she was kind of heartbroken about it. But I think that job particularly like takes its toll on a person over time.
Eventually, Rebecca left the job she loved to work for the 111 service. And then a couple of months ago, got another job that meant having to travel to a training session in Derbyshire with health workers from across the country. Sarah thinks that's where she contracted COVID-19.
She doesn't like to complain a lot, really. I think when you're a nurse, and particularly when you've worked on children's oncology, you've kind of seen the worst that can happen to a person, really. So she would never kind of complain that much about having like a cough or a fever, but I know she did have them. She would call up and say she wasn't well. She kept saying she was a sweaty mess, which for her was awful because she was so glam and she hated being sweaty.
Did she know how bad it was getting?
Well, the thing is, she really thought she was getting better, and she just a couple of hours previously spoken to her mum on the phone, and I know her mum said that she was watching Ice Planet with David Attenborough.
Oh, yeah.
because she thought it might help her cool down because she was so fevery. So she thought watching polar bears might help. And then all we know is that she'd called an ambulance that night. And the next thing was, I think, police knocking on her mum's door to say that she'd died before the ambulance had got to her. It always makes me think of a few years ago, we had a birthday party for Becca where she had this absolutely ridiculous tumble down some stairs, and she managed to break her leg in several places and dislocated it in several others. It was like a horrific accident. But even then, she wouldn't let us call an ambulance because it wasn't serious enough. So I keep thinking about that because she knew how stretched the ambulance service is. And she would never have called unless it was a matter of life and death. So it kind of chokes me up a bit how she must have really known she was in trouble.
Can you remember the moment you heard what had happened?
Yeah, so I was in bed, and Becca's mum called me in the morning. And I knew as soon as I saw that it was Marion calling, like, my heart just dropped, because I just kind of suddenly put those pieces of information together. Because Marion would never call me otherwise. She's never called me before. And yeah, she explained what had happened. And it just really felt like, I know people say a ton of bricks is such a cliche, but it really was. It felt like just suddenly everything was, I don't know, just so surreal. So she asked me to call around all of her friends and tell them what had happened. So I spent the next several hours doing that. And that was so hard. I definitely remember kind of being able to pinpoint the exact moment when people's hearts broke in their voice. And that really will stay with me, I think. That really hurt. Because she meant so much to different people. And, like, lots of people didn't know she was sick at all because she'd not said anything. And she was just, I don't know, just the last person you'd kind of expect, because, you know, there's a lot of rhetoric around, you know, this person's strong, they'll get through it. You know, if you keep going, keep fighting. But, you know, it was never a matter of that, because Becca was maybe the toughest person I've ever met. And, you know, she couldn't do it, so.
Were you able to go to Rebecca's funeral?
No. There was only a small number of people who were able to go, and of course that had to be a family, and even then, like, it was a fraction of a family that could go. So the closest I got was standing on the street as a hearse drove by. And that's so hard, because she was such a people person. So the things that are really, like, killing me is that, firstly, that she died on her own when she was such a loving person and, you know, really kind of thrived off the energy of other people. She was such an extrovert. She was an amazing friend, and she kind of lived to be with other people. So for her to have been on her own when she died is heartbreaking. But then to have a funeral with just such a sparse amount of people, and for, you know, me and other friends to just be standing on the street and just all of us crying our eyes out. And, you know, one of the hardest things about it is, like, seeing all my friends who, like we're all adored her, and not being able to give them a hug and not being able to look after each other when we're all hurting so much.
Will you do something afterwards to celebrate her life?
Oh yeah, definitely. She was going to turn 30 in June, and she was going to throw herself this huge party that was like bigger than most people's weddings because she was just extravagant. And she'd like printed off all these fancy invitations and hired out like a huge function room and everything. And she would want something like that. You know, we had a few conversations about funerals because she was just like that. And, you know, she would always joke about wanting to have like a big piss up as a funeral, just have like everyone get drunk. And she always joked about having like Highway to Hell and like Burn Baby Burn and like Spirit in the Sky, kind of like funny songs at a funeral. So I think we'll get a good playlist on for her that would kind of reflect a stupid sense of humour. I think at the moment it's really hitting me how important funerals are for grieving, really. You know, it feels like there's no closure here. There's no, like, catharsis. Just when we all need to see each other most, we can't.
Sarah, can I just ask you finally, we've been talking to a number of relatives and friends of people who have lost loved ones to COVID-19. We've been trying to understand a bit more about the type of people that this virus is killing, and we can see that some groups are more at risk. Men are more at risk, older people are more at risk, ethnic minorities are more at risk, and overall it's taken more of a toll in a huge, densely populated city like London than in more kind of rural parts of the country. I mean, Rebecca doesn't fit any of that. Does what happened to her show that however much we can talk about risk factors, there's no one who can really escape the risk of this virus?
Yeah, 100%. Like, Becca was a fabulous nurse, but in this case, she could have been anyone. She was, like, fit and healthy otherwise. She, you know, we live in Northumberland, which is fairly sparsely populated. Morpeth isn't a huge town. It really goes to show that it could be anybody and that we need to look after each other, not just ourselves, and that if you feel like you have any symptoms at all, you know, it's better to just stay home, because even if you feel like it might be nothing, you just don't know, and you don't know who it's going to affect. You don't know which of your family members are only still here because somebody didn't go to the shops.
Sarah, thank you so much.
That's okay.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
It's all right.
Absolutely heartbreaking. It's such a terrible, terrible disease.
Yeah, I know. There's going to be so many thousands of people who are grieving their loved ones, and it breaks my heart that there's, I'm not the only one feeling like this. So many people have lost their best friends and their like children and their parents and their sisters, brothers, all kinds of things.
Thank you.
That's all right. That's all right, yep.
This episode is very much a tribute to the lives of Leonard Nipper-Reed, Umar Afzal, Mervyn Mally Kennedy and Rebecca Mack. I'd like to send our condolences to their families and all the others who have lost people to COVID-19. A special thanks to James Morton, Nazir Afzal, Penny Palmer and Sarah Breeden-Kemp for sharing their stories at this difficult time. I'd also like to thank two bus drivers, Taj and Mo, still working hard, for speaking to me to help with this episode. Following such a terrible death toll, the Unite Union is now calling for the bereaved families of bus drivers to get payouts to match the £60,000 going to the loved ones of NHS and social care workers. Thank you also to our colleagues across The Guardian for their fascinating research that fed into this episode. Science correspondent Hannah Devlin has written really interesting pieces on the questions around race and gender. Do look them up and also listen to her on Science Weekly.
The data team has been doing some great work. Do read the piece by our data projects editor, Kaylin Barr, and others on the figures around BAME deaths, and from Haroon Sadiq. Also, do read the work of our big reporting team covering the stories of many more lives. Have a look for a piece called So Much Living to Do. If you're intrigued by the amazing story of Nipah Reed, do look up James Morton's books, Craze, The Final Word, and also Nipah Reed, The Man Who Nicked the Craze, which he co-wrote with the man himself. This episode was produced by Courtney Youssef and Josh Kelly, with help from Mithili Rao. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. Have a great weekend. I'm taking a week's break to spend a bit more time with my family. Rachel will be with you on Monday.